Hey, and welcome to FutureThinkers.org, a podcast about the evolution of technology, society, and consciousness. I'm Mike Gilliland.
And I'm Yuvia Ivanova. If you're new to the show and you want to get a list of our favorite books, popular episodes, and to join our community, go to FutureThinkers.org/start. All Future Thinkers episodes are now on video. To watch the premiere of each episode and join the discussion live, subscribe to our YouTube channel at FutureThinkers.org/YouTube. Welcome to Future Thinkers. Our guest in this episode is Michael Taft, meditation teacher, author of The Mindful Geek, and the creator of the Deconstructing Yourself blog and podcast. Michael has had over 35 years of meditation practice in multiple traditions and decades of teaching experience, including teaching the folks at Google how to meditate. He specializes in a secular method of teaching that is rooted in neuroscience.
In this interview, we talk about the stages of personal development, spiritual awakening, deconstructing reality, and the benefits of a regular meditation practice. For all the links and show notes for this episode, go to FutureThinkers.org/95. Before we start, we'd like to thank our new patrons and donors, Charlie and Jared, for supporting the show. Thank you, guys. Check out A Course in Personal Evolution, adapting age-old wisdom for a modern life of purpose and meaning. Go to FutureThinkers.org/evolution.
Hi, Michael. Welcome to the show. Very nice to have you.
Hey, Yuvia and Mike. It's good to be here.
Cool. So today I wanted to dive into some of the subject matter that you like to podcast quite a lot on your own show, Deconstructing Yourself, and your blog. And that is the subject matter of awakening. So I'd like to, can you give us a definition of what that is in your view? Because there's so much misunderstanding. So much misunderstanding of what that actually is and isn't.
Yeah, so first off, there's no possibility of there actually being a misunderstanding because nobody has the slightest clue what it actually is. So we all can be equally wrong or equally right about this topic, right? It's historically, even individuals in the same traditions didn't agree about what it is, let alone the, you know, huge fights between traditions about what it is. And those are traditions within even the same, let's say, general religions. And then between religions, there's vast misunderstanding or let's say difference of opinion about what it is. So let's just lay the ground by saying, you know, hopefully I'm less wrong than most of the people in the way I think about it. The other thing I would say just right off the bat is, of course, awakening used in this way is a metaphor, right? It's not the same as waking up from being asleep, which is, of course, what we normally mean by awakening. You went to bed at night and then got out of bed in the morning and that was your awakening. That's the real, you know, meaning of the term. So we're using the term awakening in this non-literal sense and a metaphoric sense of, let's say, waking up from your previous quote unquote, also used metaphorically, dream of how the world worked and what you were in it. So, in the simplest way of thinking about it, we can say awakening is awakening from the dream of being a person in the world. It's awakening from the delusion of what a human being is and what the world around a human being is. And so there's a strong flavor of meaning in the term awakening that says you're going to really know how things really are rather than, you know, your previous delusion, your previous misapprehension of self and world. What you're waking up to is a correct apprehension of self and world. So in the simplest sense, that's what we're talking about, right? You're seeing things as they really are, or understanding what you and the world really are. And I'll just pause there for a minute and after that hyper pretentious mouth load of stuff and see what you guys have to say about it.
Well, I'm curious what, if the, from your perspective, if the delusion or the illusion is context specific or if there's kind of an overarching delusion that you're speaking about.
There's several overarching delusions, but they come down to, very important survival mechanisms for beings, let's say beings, probably humans, certainly humans, but probably also at least higher mammals and so on have, I suspect, have very similar delusions since we evolved directly from them. So when I say delusion, normally people are going to think immediately, well, that's a bad thing. We don't want to be deluded. We want to be awakened. But of course, these particular delusions could be very broadly packed under the label of biases, cognitive biases. It's in the same way that we evolved to have negativity bias for really important ecological, environmental, evolutionary reasons, right? In the same way that we have various biases about, you know, the way our vision processes the world around us, or our sound identifies objects of different sorts, our ears identify objects of different sorts in the sound field. In just that same way, we have a giant overarching bias of the mind, which is to assemble self and world, and place self and world in an even broader assembly of kind of a platform of space and time, and to then conceptualize everything as an environment with things in it moving around and interacting. So this is the delusion I'm talking about. And of course, it's an extremely useful, helpful delusion that helps us turn, you know, food into adults, right? Food into babies, into adults over and over again for a billion years. So it's not that this delusion is somehow useless or wrong. It's just not the whole story. And in terms of being a human being, there's certain things about this delusion that can be somewhat painful destructive. And when we learn to overcome this delusion or see through the delusion, even a little bit, it can be massively helpful for both our well-being and the well-being of others. Or if we see through the delusion in a way that's unsupported or, let's say, half-baked, it can be very destructive and very unhelpful.
It's like the psychopath factory.
Psychopath factory, the psychosis factory, you know, very different things. And also, you know, we just didn't really evolve to notice this. We evolved on purpose to not notice it. And if there's any way you can avoid noticing this, I usually recommend you just forget everything I'm saying and go back to your life, you know. But for most of us, at some point, most of us involved in such a conversation, anyone who's going to listen to this and care about it all at all has probably already begun to notice this or had experiences of noticing it deeply, and then you're stuck. You know, now it's time to, you got to dig all the way through.
I'd like to chat a bit about the path from your perspective. Do you think there's kind of stages along the way that are very recognizable to someone who's already gone through it, and maybe someone can be helped through it? And is there an endpoint that is arrived at?
Yeah, so that's like the kind of double question that we could like dialogue about for a really, really long time. And that would be a fun time for me. But I'll try to boil it down a little bit. I think that there are recognizable states and stages, but they are recognizable states and stages in a, like a hyper object around, you know, called awakening. And there's so many different paths in, so many different paths through, so many different ways of engaging this, that it's almost insane to even talk about path. Really, the more you work with people, especially people who are encountering this outside of tradition or in a very different tradition, their quote unquote path can just look so different. And we'll talk about why that is. Remind me to talk about why that is. But that being said, you know, human brains are human brains. They have certain types of responses to certain types of situations or certain understandings. So there are some recognizable, you know, states and stages that people can encounter or get near and have their own version of. And furthermore, you know, once you work with this a lot, you know, I work with a lot of people all day long, and this is what we're talking about continuously and where I'm guiding people continuously. It starts to become, there's like these strange attractors or recognizable states and stages where it's like, oh, they're getting close to that one thing. So let's talk about that and start working with that recognizable way station. I could go on, but I'll just sort of trail off there for a minute and say, what was the second part of your question?
Is there an endpoint?
Yeah. So I don't think there is. And I don't think there is because, or let's put it this way, the endpoint is when you're dead. And between, you know, now and the time you're dead, there's always something new to learn. I don't think there's any such thing as complete, you're fully done awakening. There's always more to be learned. There's always more to be experienced in a new way. It can always be more creative and engaged and interactive with other people. And furthermore, you know, the brain is a complex object, and parts of it can be fully awake, and whole bunches of other parts of it can be really not awake, as we see with many teachers and spiritual leaders around the world. They seem to have some awakeness in some parts of their brain, and other parts seem to be dead asleep. And I'm, you know, no exception. And I think we need to understand that even, let's say, even in the model that I don't agree with, but let's say even in the model that there is some kind of final awakening, even in that model, you still have to do all the work of psychology to, you know, have a kind and functioning mind. And then beyond that, all the work of intersubjective interaction to take, you know, compassionate action in the world, to engage with life in a beautiful, exuberant, creative, powerful, effective manner. That never ends, right? We're always learning. We're always learning to do things more expressively and also more effectively. So I don't think there is an end state. I think there is, there are, however, important things you can learn. And we could take each of those as a potential, like, okay, you've done what you need to do spiritually, at least for the moment. Now go play or go do something useful in the world for a while. Let that bake in, let that settle in and kind of get integrated, and then maybe come back and you'll be ready for another dose of further awakening.
Yeah, I really love the framework that Ken Wilber talks about. Wake up, grow up, clean up, show up. So yeah. Just, you know, just because you're awake or at least awake to some degree doesn't mean you're a grown up, responsible person. Doesn't mean you have cleaned up all of your issues or your traumas or the ways that you're an asshole. And doesn't mean that you show up for people or serve in any kind of meaningful way.
Yeah. In fact, it probably means you haven't done any of those things because you've been sitting in a retreat center, you know, staring at the wall. So it's, you know, even more important to go do all those three other things besides wake up, and then come back around and wake up some more, and then do those three things and come back around and wake up some more, and maybe doing all four at once. You know, it just depends. Everyone's path is so utterly unique. But it's crucial that we don't forget the cleaning up and the growing up and the showing up, right? These are hugely important parts of human life. And Wilber has always been very good about this. There's, you know, things you can disagree with him about at great length, but this basic model that he's had for decades of awakening happening along development happening along different lines of human expression is really clear and has always been very, very helpful. Yeah.
I know that recently there has been kind of a movement to eradicate all hierarchies.
And especially in universities, a lot of professors are pushing this idea that hierarchies don't exist or that they're always about power. And Ken Wilber obviously has his whole model is based on hierarchies, but as hierarchies of development. So for somebody who doesn't recognize hierarchy, how can this idea be put into perspective in a way that makes sense and that is valuable?
Which idea, Yuvi?
The idea of awakening.
Yeah, so let's first of all talk about hierarchies, right? As Wilber has always been clear about, you can't say there aren't hierarchies. I mean, that's just stupid. Atoms form out of, you know, subatomic particles. That's a hierarchy. Molecules form out of atoms. Now we've got a two-tier hierarchy. It's just a fact of physical existence that hierarchies exist. What people are upset about, and rightly so, are dominator hierarchies, right? Hierarchies whose, you know, where the oppression is baked into them, where there's some kind of very unequal relationship enforced in the hierarchy structure. And so that's the thing to be upset about or trying to eradicate or do something about or point out, at least, that dominator hierarchies have a very negative impact. And when you're involved in a dominator hierarchy, it's destructive to you and to everyone else who is involved in that. And so, but it is possible to have hierarchies that are not dominator hierarchies. They're simply structural facts about how systems are arranged. And to say that you could have a system, you know, that all systems would be best if they were totally flat just limits our options. Why limit our options? Some systems are going to have hubs, and there might be a hub of hubs. And, you know, that in a way is a hierarchy. Some of those hubs have more connections. And so in quotes, they're more important. But that doesn't mean they have to be dominating and destructive. It could mean that they're the most facilitating and open hubs, right? They're the kindest, most compassionate part of the hierarchy might be the top of it. It just depends. And so this view that hierarchies don't exist or are all bad is just, I think, ridiculous and limiting in a way that is totally unhelpful. I think at the it's interesting, our center in San Francisco, where I teach and support the San Francisco Dharma Collective, was formed out of the smoldering ruin of Against the Stream, you know, that went down about 6 months ago due to sex scandals. And the students decide, I had been talking in because I've been reading a whole bunch of books about the October Revolution during that time. And just like China Miéville's book on the October Revolution and some other ones that are just wonderful. And so I was kind of filled with this language, like, you know, of that time. And so in the talks during that time, previous to the collapse of Against the Stream, I kept in a very joking way saying, you know, this is the Soviet of meditation workers and their deputies. And we're just going to collapse the hierarchy here. And the meditation workers and their deputies are going to, you know, start teaching each other meditation and teaching each other what we know and all that. And I liked doing that. It was fun. And the people also really liked it. I mean, everyone does have something to share that's very important. And so much later, when Against the Stream collapsed, they literally formed the San Francisco Dharma Collective and said, no teachers, there is no guiding teacher, there's nobody in charge, this is a totally flat hierarchy. And I thought that was amazing. It's a great idea. And at the same time, what are they discovering? Well, there are people they want to hear from, people they want to learn from. So, you know, they are bringing in teachers. I'm one of the teachers that's brought in, but it's kind of cool. I mean, I have literally zero power there. You know, I don't get to vote on anything. I'm like not part of the deciding structure of any part of it. Someday I might be part of like a you know, teacher recommendation council for bringing other teachers in. But that sort of de facto accumulation of influence and power and so on that tends to happen in spiritual communities is short-circuited there in a way that I think is really cool. It keeps it from being a dominator hierarchy, you know? And at the same time, I think over time, and I'm just guessing, you know, we're going to understand that there still will need to be a teacher's council to talk about who comes in and teaches and who doesn't, even though they don't have like veto power on anything. So in other words, there will be some mini hierarchy in there in some ways, but the dominator aspects of it will not be enforced or not even be possible. Just a guess, but I think that's really fascinating. So to get to your real question, though, I don't really think there is a hierarchy of awakening in the way that people would normally mean that. I do think there are different depths. It's very clear to me, just if I talk to someone for a little while, because I, you know, do this all day long, I can usually get a sense of, if they're willing to answer some pointed questions, I can get a sense of what part of awakening they've understood and what part they maybe haven't, and what parts are really clear and what parts aren't, and how it's integrating into their life or not integrating into their life. And so we can say there are different lines of awakening, different channels of awakening, and it can be clear that various ones of those can be happening to different depths. And so to whatever extent that creates a hierarchy of awakening, I can see that. But again, it's not a dominator hierarchy unless we're part of a larger organization where people are being given power and influence and money and, you know, access and all that based on, you know, let's say my decision about how awake they are. That's where it gets ugly and competitive and confusing and destructive. And even though I sit around all day talking about awakening and how I think it's a great thing and how we need to be there, I think rating people based on it or somehow, you know, giving them more money, power, influence in life based on it is totally unsupportable, and that, you know, we should work to not do that. Even though humans seem to be wired to do that, you know, we out of the womb, we seem to want to have, I guess it's because we have parents. As we grow up, we want to have parental figures. And I've just seen this happen over and over again. But as, let's say, the human species grows up more and more and more, wakes up, grows up, shows up, cleans up, I think there will be much, much less of that kind of issue happening.
I hope so.
Me too.
Yeah. There's also the other side of this where, and maybe this is an older idea, but it definitely still exists, that awakened people are somehow morally superior or better than other people just by default. And that also relates to the idea of, you know, waking up is not the same as growing up, cleaning up and showing up.
Yeah, it's directly related. And obviously, awake people are not morally superior out of the box in any way, not in any way. And we can just see this over and over again. People who have been like certified awakened by their real serious tradition for a long time still can manifest some of the ugliest behavior humans are possible of, and some of the most morally reprehensible behavior humans are possible of. Capable of. And so it's just one of those artifacts of history that we need to toss in the waste bin and figure this out once and for all, that awakening does not mean you are morally superior. It not necessarily mean you are morally superior. It doesn't necessarily mean you have magic powers. It doesn't necessarily mean shit, except that you've seen something about how the experience of being human works. And that something is important and interesting, but It's the sense you make of it and the structures around it that help you clean up, grow up, show up that are crucial to the moral, let's say, worth of that awakening. That being said, I do want to add that certain lines of awakening and levels of awakening do make cleaning up, showing up, you know, what's the other one?
Clean up, grow up, show up.
Grow up. Yeah. Cleaning up, growing up, showing up easier. Some levels and lines of awakening make it a lot easier to, let's say, work on your psychology if you are supported in doing that. They make it a lot easier to show up in a helpful, like very interconnected, diverse way if you're interested and supported in doing that. So it's all of those support and help each other, right, in the best model, but they don't cover the same ground as each other. It's not just one circle. And I think it's mythology that says they do.
Yeah. And it's funny because I haven't studied a whole lot of scripture. So I don't know a lot of these kinds of questions of how things are done in the different traditions. But we grew up with Christianity. So I know that in Christianity, there's this idea of saints. And I wonder if that has something to do with how awakening is seen in the West, because before, Buddhism and Hinduism was brought into the West, I don't think they had this idea of awakening. It was more about sainthood. So I wonder if they got mixed up at some point.
Yeah, there's a lot to say about that. I will say this, if you read like biographies of Christian saints, which I've read dozens and dozens of full biographies of those, and then you hang out with, let's say, Hindu saints or Buddhist saints in quotes, you know, but they have similar words that mean a very similar thing, or you read their biographies, hagiography is hagiography. It sounds the same in every religion, at least that I've seen. The idea of a person who is spiritually superior, morally superior, somehow magically blessed by the divine, it seems to be an archetype. And yes, it is expressed differently in different cultures. And yet, man, the more you encounter it, the more it just seems like the same human idea that there's a parent who is the good parent, you know, and these just happen to be magically good parents. And any sort of deity is like a cosmically good parent. And we just can't, you know, it might just be an artifact of the way our biology works, that we're horribly helpless as infants and have to completely depend on these adult figures, that this bleeds over into the psychology of our entire lives, where we keep looking for these more and more perfected adult figures to tell us what's real and tell us what to do and keep us safe. And sadly, I've never met such a being, you know. And I spent lots of decades trying to find them. I've been around people who had some amazing qualities, like unbelievable qualities, things that did seem magical or wildly powerful or whatever, at least at the time. It's not like I'm saying I for sure don't know that exists. I'm just saying even they had their failings, even they, you know, stank and you know, had to use the bathroom and did stupid shit and had bad advice for people and stuff. And so I haven't seen one of these perfectly awakened saints. I do like it in the Christian tradition, one of the nice things or one of the useful things is that saints aren't considered to be perfect in that way. You know, they're still human and have clay feet and, you know, they're sinners and all that, but they just are like channels for divine energy sometimes. And so there's sort of a built-in skepticism about their, you know, like moral perfection or the fact that, you know, we understand that they also did a bunch of stupid shit, just like everybody else. So I do like that particular understanding, because that's gone in some of the other saint traditions, where you can be perfect in every possible way. You were born perfect, your childhood, you were an amazing being, you know, all these miracles happened just every time they changed your diapers, and, you know, it just goes on and on. And again, I have an open mind. Show me someone like that. I'd love to meet them. I'll go hang out with them, you know, but I haven't met them.
Yeah, it's funny. History seems to scrub out the dirty aspects of sainthood with the more time that goes by. I also found it interesting what you were saying about kind of finding the middle ground. I guess you didn't really say this, but I was thinking it while you were talking about giving up your authority to someone who can teach you, or finding your own authority, but then becoming a bit of an arrogant know-it-all, and how difficult it is for people to find this middle ground of being open, willing to learn, but also not just giving up their sovereignty to someone else.
Yeah. And boy, there's a lot to say about that. It's a huge issue. It's really interesting. As an arrogant know-it-all myself, I feel like I have so much I can share about it. But again, it's a really obvious problem, and yet everyone's susceptible to it. Like, why does it have to be that just because, you know, I'm teaching you to meditate and pointing out aspects of reality, that, you know, you also start, that one also starts having these feelings that I somehow, you know, have something really important to say about global warming or something. I mean, you know, or your marriage choice or whatever. It's just like when you go to the doctor, you don't ask them for investment advice. And if you do, you're an idiot, you know? So, or let's say misguided. And so, same thing. If you go to the person who's teaching you about meditation or awakening, or, you know, I would say, let's say, contacting deeply the experience of being you in the world and what it means to be a you in the world, and so on, that's great. A person who can even show you a little bit of that can show you some really powerful, interesting stuff. But I wouldn't ask them for investment advice. You know, I wouldn't ask them for health and medical advice. You know, it's just an overlapping of their authority field into a zone where they don't know what they're talking about, you know, and we grew up thinking our parents know everything. And then little by little, you realize they're just sad, scared, confused monkeys too. And you know, you start to take on that burden yourself. And then, unfortunately, we tend to then start asking experts. That's a good thing as long as we keep them in their domain, you know, authority field or whatever, where they appear to know what they're talking about. And yet, as you know, the further you go into any of those, every expert is just a sad, scared monkey who's as confused as anybody else, right? And so it's not that they can't be helpful, but the minute you, first of all, you know, they're, even in their field, there's going to be major disagreements about the core points of everything. So they're just guessing, and, you know, and so are you. And so what's fascinating to me is that, can we just acknowledge that and then have these much more loose, open, cooperative facilitator hierarchies? Okay, you're the doctor, you're helping us with medicine, but hey, I'm the podcaster. I can help you get your word out, and I do my thing. And, you know, I'm the meditation teacher. I mean, it's ridiculously simple to talk about, right? And yet, for whatever reason, we have a very hard time doing that as humans.
Yeah, it seems to be that idea of the benevolent parent again, where you just, a part of you wants to believe that there's a person who will just have all the answers.
And be right, all the right answers, and be totally on your side. And I, you know, again, please, I hope one of those shows up. It would make my day, you know. But sadly, the longer I live, the more it seems there is no such parent available. And so we got to do the best we can with our own communities and our own best guesses and our own compassion and our own connection, right? And that, you know, there's something really lovely about, to me, about that. It's so grounded. Like, okay, let's give up all the fantasies, maybe even staying open to them being possible, but until they show up, let's just set those down and start with the real humbleness, the humility of humanity, right? It's all the same. All those come from the same word, like meaning dirt, right? Let's just be as humble and simple as the dirt and as rooted and grounded as the earth and just start working from there. And there's something really, I don't know, I find that like beautiful and powerful.
What are some of your favorite questions that new students ask you?
You know, anything where I can show off and seem smart. So, you know, it's fun to, you know, be an expert in an area that someone's interested in. So there's that. But really it's if they're coming at it and they really do think like, I'm gonna do this enlightenment thing. I'm gonna do this awakening thing and I'm gonna become powerful and famous and get all the sex partners I want and all the money I want. But more, I'm going to feel good about myself and I'm going to be helping the world and all that. You know, that's whether they're aware of it or not, that's a very normal vision. Somewhere in there is just like, I'll just kind of be not just really good, but like super good. I'll kind of have a superpower of being awesome. I mean, like, well, again, no one would ever say it like that. But as you probe a little bit, it's not that uncommon of a vision. I certainly, you know, had that vision. Yeah, have superpowers, and great. Who wouldn't want that if it's actually existing? That's why I don't really judge that viewpoint because if it existed, it'd be worth having, right? Like, hey, I can help the world with my superpowers, like. You know, Deadpool or something. But
what a terrible example that was.
I really like that. That's the one like you chose out of all like the superheroes.
Like Magneto, yeah. But you know, why not if that existed? But so if someone comes with that viewpoint, I'm like, okay, let's start working with this. But there's going to be a lot of deconstruction going on. You know, of that. And so some of the more favorite questions I have come from kind of the other side of the aisle, or, you know, maybe the other side of the spectrum, where it's like, I just keep seeing through everything and I can't understand that. And it's confusing. You know, that's a very open, direct question that's not coming from a lot of reading or a lot of mythology or a lot of wand. They're just starting to wake up and need some guidance. A lot of people start to wake up through the use of entheogens. And although there can be a tremendous amount of just sort of like extra content in there that we have to clear out, the basic, you know, my ego seemed to disappear and the world got really, really, really interesting kind of direct experience view. I love to work with that, right? It's very, we can go into hardcore practice of the Vipassana or of some kind, but we can also do some non-dual awakening type stuff. We can mix those two things together, or I can just talk to their experience, right? But because they're coming from a little bit more of a, in the good sense, in the positive sense of the word, naive viewpoint, where it's not loaded up with a ton of extra ideas, it can be just really fun to work with. But also, honestly, just as a teacher, one of the questions I like the most is just, you know, I'm dedicated to doing this 4 hours a day. What can I do? You know, I'm like, awesome. We could really get somewhere with just gumption, you know. So that kind of like, you know, send me in, coach, kind of attitude. Really, I respond to that. You know, my father was a high school football coach and track coach and wrestling coach, so I was raised around that mood, and so I respond to that really well. Someone who's just gung ho is awesome. I'm about to go to 5 month long retreats in Southeast Asia. What do you want me to do? I'm like, let's talk. we could really work together here. Yeah, that's awesome.
There's this great mushroom bar in Copenhagen. Go up the hill.
That's right.
And order yourself
on
a
the
shake.
Beach, there'll be a full moon.
Can we talk about some of the techniques for doing this sort of thing? What are some of your favorites that you like to suggest people do?
And when you say this type of thing, do you want me to just wade in there, or do you have like a really specific type of thing?
Yeah, I know that.
I keep offering you the menu because the menu's large.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess I'm stumped.
Okay, I'll just wade in. You know, I'm a student of Shinzen, right? I was doing Hindu Tantra for a long, long time and then started working with Shinzen Young, who is, I think, amazingly creative teacher, which is one of the rarest things in this world, is a spiritual teacher who's actually creative instead of just sticking to, you know, the greatest hits of their practice tradition where they know they're on solid ground forever. Shinzen's willing to just experiment like crazy and then tell you what works. And that turns out to be what worked for him and what might work for you. And that turns out to be actually way more common than you think. Like some of these practice traditions that we're working with now in the world that are considered to be very solid and very rooted in thousands of years of practice actually go back like maybe 120 years. All of Vipassana in the world only goes back 120 years in terms of practice. Scriptures are much older. The practices go back to the historical Buddha if that person existed, but you know, somewhere in the middle of the 1800s, there was no person on earth that anyone could find who knew how to do Vipassana as a practice. And the king of Thailand looked high and low, far and wide, to find such a person for anti-colonial reasons. I'm going down the rabbit hole. I'll back up and say, so Shinzen is a creative meditation teacher, which I really like. And this, let's call it a tradition of being a creative meditator who then teaches is actually richer than one might think. Even though these days it's still rare, it's rich, but rare. And he tends to teach this very complex form of Vipassana that's highly informed by Zen. This complex form of Vipassana takes the form of Mahasi noting, but to come out of all the jargon, we would just say that we look at the experience of what it's like to be you in the world as a undifferentiated lump. Like, let's just be with your experience right now. And learn to do that in a very phenomenological way, right? What it's like to be you, not the story of you, but, you know, sensory experience moment by moment. And that's normal Vipassana. That's just mindfulness, right? In an open monitoring kind of way. But then in the Shinzen style, we break that down into sensory channels. Since what we're interested in is sensory experience, and we're going to dig down into sensory experience, we do the science model, right? We take a giant undifferentiated lump, we analyze it into parts, in this case, sensory channels, sensory modalities, sight, hearing, and so on, body sensations of emotion, various types of thinking. We're going to call those different sensory channels and then learn to meditate on each of those in a Vipassana way, like speed noting, what's arising next, what's arising next, what's arising next in each of those sensory channels. And then we'll call those monads, right? Just get as nerdy as possible here because that's how Shinzen teaches. So I'll imitate Shinzen do a poor imitation of Shinzen in the sense of get kind of nerdy with it. We look at the monads, we get really good at those, then we watch the interactions of dyads, triads, tetrads, and so on of sense modalities, and then come back to the lump, the full enchilada, the everything bagel, the what it's like to be me right now. But it's not an undifferentiated mass anymore. we've clarified this object as it's functioning, right? We're watching it while it runs, but we've learned to clarify these sensory channels. Then you do it again. You go back and go deeper into each channel, get more and more rarefied, more hyper clarified, high resolution, fine grain, fine detail, vivid, bright contact with the phenomenological uprising of each sense modality. Then watch them interact, dyads, triads, tetrads, etc. Then the whole thing again, what it's like to be me, but now it's even clearer, 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 clearer. Right? So to me, this is the process I call deconstructing yourself. That's where, you know, that's my name for it. That's the title of most of the stuff I do, right? Because I love that technique. And there's a couple great things about it. But I'll pause instead of monologuing and see if there's questions or feedback before monologuing.
Yeah, that actually reminds me of a study that somebody mentioned today, the study of Buddhist monks that the Dalai Lama picked, you know, the monks that he thought were the most awakened. And then they the researchers put them in an MRI machine. And what they found is that the frequency of their minds, their brains, were different than non-meditators. And I'm quoting somebody's description of the study, so I might get a few things wrong. But the idea was that to a normal person, it's 40 hertz, and experienced meditator, it's 80 hertz. So it's like they have higher resolution of their experience of the world and also their experience of time.
Yes. And it's easier to explain than you think. You know, if you are a pianist, the area of your brain that governs fine motor control of your fingers is much larger than that same area of a non-pianist brain, right? Because you've just learned to have very fine motor control of your fingers. And so it's like beefed up the motor control center of your brain, right? And in a meditator, the main thing that is beefed up is the insula, the two insular cortices, which govern how you feel your guts, how you feel the inside of your body. And so the insular cortices get much, much larger in a meditator than a non-meditator, and larger in long-term meditators than short-term meditators. So it seems to be directly correlated. And it makes sense because you're feeling your internal experience so much that it's building up that ability to feel internal experience in a more fine-grained way, right? You actually have kind of a bigger graphics processor in your mind, right? So it's getting more details. And that turns out to be really important, right? It's important for intuition. It's important for emotion. It's important for connecting and understanding other people. I mean, that little change is a big deal. The other change, one of the other major changes, is that the prefrontal cortex gets a lot of gets buff, right? The medial prefrontal cortex, and that's sort of your overarching, you know, ability to control impulses, you know, and to sit with difficult stuff. Whereas maybe the animal self kind of wants to get out of this uncomfortable feeling. We all know that being able to sit in a relaxed way with an uncomfortable feeling is what, like, the definition of adulting, right? Like, well, I don't want to do my taxes right now. In fact, my animal like wants to go out and play in the sun, but I actually need to do this for various reasons. So that kind of, like, you know, longer term control over impulses is another thing that gets really emphasized in a meditator's brain. So the thing I'm describing, the kind of practice I'm describing, is going to make it much, much easier to not only feel your internal state, but because we're doing all sensory channels, you get actually better at hearing in detail, better at seeing in detail, you know, like seeing like an artist or hearing like a musician in that phenomenological way, the sound of the sound, the way colors and shapes look, that kind of detail. But, you know, we can measure this kind of stuff. This isn't just me spewing. You know, someone who even relatively new meditators who've increased their concentration ability to a measurable sense, which you can do even after 3 months of practice, 3 months of pretty intensive practice, but still 3 months of practice, you reduce the blind spot time in your attention. So there's a thing called the attentional blink, right? Have you guys heard of this?
It's like the refresh rate and the space between the flickering refresh of your perception.
Kind of, yeah. It turns out that let's say we have a string of numbers whipping by on a screen, which is usually the test they give people. And they say, whenever you see a letter, I want you to, you know, indicate. So string of numbers, and then the odd thing out is letters. So boom, boom, boom. And they discovered this really interesting feature, which is, you know, when it's slow, everyone can see all the letters. They speed it up. It's harder, but you can still see the letters. But when it gets to a certain speed that I can't remember, but like, let's say tenths of a second, you see the first letter. And then if a letter happens a long time later, you'll see that. But if the second letter happens right after the first one, you will miss it. And there's a window in there. And let's say, I can't remember, but let's say a tenth of a second. And it's called the attentional blink, because it's like you saw the first one and now your eyes are closed for a second until the next one. And because default human beings tend to have the same attentional blink rate. It's like a specified time, so similar that they thought it was like a hard wired feature of the human, you know, nervous system. But it turns out meditators who have focused hard on concentration, their attentional blink shrinks to almost nothing. So when we're, you know, they see the second letter and a third letter and a fourth letter, almost no matter how fast you throw them at them.
I wonder if heavy Twitch gamers get the same response.
Probably. I mean, especially if they are, you know, some of those guys and gals are sitting there and whatever other genders are sitting there like doing that 12 hours straight, right? On as much caffeine as possible and with as much focus as possible. So maybe, you know, concentration is concentration. And what I think is so interesting, though, is that when I'm saying things like, yeah, you get finer grain perception, I'm not just spewing or being deluded. You can prove that that is real in a very low level way in the nervous system. So it's really, really fascinating. And it shows in many different features of the meditator's brain. But there's a downside to all that, too. Right, there's huge upsides, but there's a downside, and one of the main downsides is, well, if you're building up all this fine grain sensitivity, what about when you feel your feelings and your feelings suck, you know, or you're looking at something ultra disturbing, you know, and you're getting this fine grained, beautiful, or fine grained, hyper upsetting imagery, and then you're feeling the feelings with all this very heightened perception, that's not a good moment, right? That's a freak out moment. And, or let's say you have barely treated PTSD and you're kind of just keeping a lid on things and getting through your day, but now we amp up your perception of your own distress and it starts to turn into a feedback loop. Boom, right? That's not good. And so it should go without saying, but in fact, it never is said almost. So I will say it over and over that you have to, number one, tiptoe in there carefully to not just kind of knock yourself off track or right off the entire table. And B, you know, make sure you build in the crucial feature of equanimity to these, you know, to your meditation experience. In other words, just building up concentration and this kind of high grain sensitivity would be actually detrimental to your life you just, you know, become like someone who every sound was too loud and every feeling was too much and people's faces were too intense. So you just stay home and in the dark with your noise canceling headphones on for the rest of your life. Like, that's not what we want, right? That's not a positive outcome. And so learning little by little to handle and be with in a relaxed way this sensitivity and concentration and clarity is vastly important. In fact, it's more important than the other things. If you just develop equanimity on its own, that is powerful stuff, right? And so I keep seeing, I'll just make sort of a unfair generalization, but you know, when I used to go to Asian retreat centers, they were like extremely difficult places. Like, we would run out of food or run out of water or be covered in bugs all the time or sitting on cement in a hugely hot or hugely cold, all kinds of very uncomfortable things. And that's just the way it was. And I'm not saying that out of some sense of, you know, the macho war story of the meditator, but, or I should say, and it's true. I mean, that's just what it was like, you know? And here you go to a retreat center and it's like, you know, well, my cushions are too hard and there's a smell in the other room and there's, you know, squeaking, a chirping of a bird outside and it's upsetting.
That guy's breathing too loud.
Well, yeah, guy. Well, and I don't like the color of his shirt. And I mean, again, this is an unfair caricature, but it's the kind of environment where we're sort of like not encouraging people's equanimity to grow, you know, encouraging them to, in a kind way, in a compassionate way, little by little, to grow their tolerance for discomfort, because the tolerance for discomfort is crucial. And I want to distinguish between the grit, you know, tight, macho, I can take it, tolerance for discomfort, which is brittle and breaks and does not work, and actual equanimity, which is loose and open and a literal retraining of your nervous system to relax as things get uncomfortable rather than tighten up. And so this is a crucial feature with all this high resolution sensory clarity stuff. So that kind of practice to me has a couple great features, one of which is that as you drill down into each sense modality, you strip away layers of conceptualization and conceptualization, getting more and more into the phenomenology of it, deeper and deeper, until even if you do it well in one modality, you'll start to have awakening experiences. But as you do it in more and more modalities, drilling down past through layers of conceptualization, through layers of thinking about the sense material instead of experiencing it, and then even more deeply into like the what I would loosely call the pre-processing circuits of the sensory processing parts of the brain, you're getting into awakening territory. And so it's powerful for having deep insights into the nature of self and world. And it's also good because you're looking at the interacting sense fields and looking at how that's built into the sense of me, you know, what it's like to be me in the world right now. If you, instead of drilling down into kind of the signal processing level of the senses, if instead of that you stay in the content level, you know, not just the phenomenology, but the content, it also functions as a psychological practice, an extremely effective psychological practice that can be wedded with other, you know, psychology and psychological practices very, very effectively. Like, the most simple version of that is, just to give you an example of what I mean, is if you're meditating on body sensations of emotion, you almost don't care what emotion it is. You're just, well, those are the butterflies in my stomach. And at first it's like a thing, but as I concentrate on it day after day, week after week, year after year, it turns into just vibration and then eventually emptiness, right? You just go down in. You're just ignoring the content basically entirely and getting into the experience, right? That's how Vipassana works. It's a process meditation. But you could potentially back up with that same meditation and instead contact the emotion as content. Oh, I'm anxious right now. And notice in this other channel, this particular thought image is arising while that anxiety feeling is coming up. And I stay with the content and watch the system working. That's a psychologically powerful kind of meditation. And so this deconstructing yourself way of working is so cool because it makes room for both of those. And that helps the grow up part as well as the wake up part. So I think it's more integrative in that way. Everyone likes their own practice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the content part is interesting. It's like in our course, we were just doing a section on logical fallacies and cognitive distortions. And it's that, basically. How are your ideas about yourself and the world completely flawed? Not even on a sometimes it's phenomenology, like, you know, because you feel depressed, you think that the world is a depressing place. But some of it is just your thinking is incorrect. And by observing your thinking in this kind of way, you can also arrive at some very interesting conclusions.
Yes, indeed, right? And you have to stay at the content level to understand a logical fallacy, mm-hmm. right? For the most part. And yet, if you go into the process level, go into the phenomenology of thinking, right? And again, in this way of meditating, you meditate directly on thoughts, you know, as sensory objects, you know, mainly talking, blah, blah, blah in my head, but also visualization in my head. So that's a internal visualization, internal verbalization. Those are just sound and pictures. And so you can let go of the content, begin to just experience them as sound and vision and drill way down past any conceptualization whatsoever, just to like the raw internal sense, whatever we call it, internal sense experience of the mind, of the thinking mind. And that turns out to be kind of what various traditions are getting at one way or another when they're talking about like don't know mind or sort of like divine confusion or something. Because as you get down below concepts into just the phenomenology of thinking, really, really interesting stuff happens and deep experiences. And not just awakening experiences, but creative experiences, insights into self and world, brand new ideas about all kinds of stuff, but also a fundamental disbelief in ideas.
Mm-hmm.
You know? Or at least a huge, it's like the world's deepest skepticism, you know, like just let's build these up. And like in this kind of working, you notice over and over again that a belief is just a feeling about a thought. You have some thoughts that arise and some emotional feeling comes up that's really strong. That's what you believe. I mean, so what? You have some thoughts and some feelings about it. That's, you know, like, who cares? And so it encourages and actually becomes unavoidable that belief just starts to dissolve, you know, and that becomes really interesting. And we're just talking about one way of working, right? There's thousands of ways of working. So I don't want to turn this into a long commercial for this one thing. I think that awakening as a topic, one of the cool things about it is it's probably, and this is just me just, you know, spewing, not even my own ideas, you know, but I'm not saying this is true, but let's just say probably awakening is already present in everybody's mind. It's just the state of your mind when you were a baby, right? The state of your mind with no concepts and no differentiation between self and world and not even differentiation between the senses. It's just pure activity. And that kind of bare metal ground floor of the mind is always there. And then we're layering in a very effective, powerful, useful way, layering concepts and experience and context and interaction and all that on top of it to function well in the world. And of course, we're never going to regress to being a baby again. And that would not be a good thing if we could. But what is interesting is if you're stuck at the top of this pyramid for the rest of your life, all the mistakes in the different layers of the pyramid and all the random shit that happened to you that built stuff into various layers of the pyramid and all that is kind of fossilized. And now you're really, a prisoner at the peak of this pyramid. And what I think, non-dual type awakening gives us the power to do is experience all the different layers of the pyramid, all the way down to the ground level or near the ground level as an adult, and then be able to come back level by level and do some of the grow up work too. Like, let's just roughly say fix or improve some of those layers, right? Our understandings of the world, things that are our habitual reactions, things that we think are our core personality turn out just to be habits. And we can really, really improve that whole stack, the human being stack, in a way that is, I think, powerful and beautiful and effective. And it's fascinating to me how many teachers who understand non-duality throw that model out, just toss it away. They agree, yes, non-dual awakening is always present. It's always been there. It's the core of your being. But you don't actually get it you don't actually understand it. You're not really awake if you then try to use it to improve yourself.
Really? That's so odd to me.
That's just buying into duality, Yuvi. You're so asleep right now. Right? I mean, you just bought into the fiction of self and world and that there's anything to improve and blah, 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 blah. That is the typical understanding, not a radical understanding. Because somehow, once you wake up to, you awake to, we'll just keep using this word non-dual for as a synonym for awakening. But think about it. The word non-dual just means all the concepts are stripped away, all the layers of processing, and you're as bare metal as you can get. And in fact, what you notice as you go, even in the deconstructing yourself kind of Vipassana I was describing, eventually you notice you can't even separate the sensory activity anymore because it's all just vibratory stuff happening. So it's just one sense. And furthermore, you can't, in that pile of vibratory stuff happening, there's no difference between the senses of the me over here and the thing over there. It's all just over there in a pile. And, occurring, and that is projected into awareness, right? But that's where you get the loss of the separation between self and other, the loss of the idea that there's anything to do or improve, because all content is gone, right? And it's not, there's no content anymore. There's just a bunch of activity on a screen, and even the screen isn't there, that's just more activity. So you can see how from that viewpoint, the idea that there's anything to improve at all, well, that's just content, let that dissolve. I get what they're saying, of course, but anyone who claims that that's their experience all day long, every moment of every day, all day long, literally every millisecond of every moment of every day, well, how are they even getting up and walking across the room to go to the bathroom, right? It wouldn't work. And so as soon as we, admit that there's a world at all and not just, the appearance of sensory arising to a solipsistic oneness, but let's say there is a real world at all and that we must interact in it in any way, now we're in the world of duality and we can start to improve things and change things and grow up and show up and clean up. And in fact, I think that it's, incumbent upon us to do that as much as we possibly can. And furthermore, ridiculous to do anything else, but that's just my opinion. You know, it's like, no, we, you know, it's not just, well, I've found non-duality, now I'm perfect and I don't need to change anything, which that is, you know, that kind of ultimate spiritual bypass is very in effect with lots of folks. And instead we want to say, look, I'm not here to be a good meditator. I'm not here to say, well, I woke up and now I'm awake and that's it. I'm done. I'm here to live well, help love well, help others live well, you know, manifest kindness and brilliance and beauty, right? I mean, and that's in content, that's in duality. Having that informed by awakening is exquisite. Having that permanently dissolved in awakening is just, you know, mud.
A waste.
Yeah.
Do you see, when you look out at the world, the trend going in the direction of more and more people awakening? I mean, you hear every once in a while when you're reading spiritual books that people say, now's the time. It's a grand awakening. People are becoming awake all over the world. And then I think about the access to information and how connected we are. And I contrast that against some of the bad ideas that we have and some of the bad influences of, say, social media and the internet. So I kind of look out and think we have a grand opportunity, but I don't know that the trend is moving. I don't exactly know where the trend is moving. So I'm wondering if you can kind of comment on that.
Yeah, I don't know about the overall trend line. I think that we do have access to information, but a lot of it is bad information. You know, we have access to all these traditions, but we've absorbed all the crust and mythology of the tradition in an uncritical way also. I think that each culture that has, I'll just take just Buddhism as an example, each culture that encountered Buddhism then spent about 500 years absorbing Buddhism into their culture and making their own version of it that matched their experience with their own awake people from inside the culture. It takes a long time to really understand how it works for you. Joseph Campbell said that no religion can cross a cultural boundary without becoming something entirely different. No mythology can cross a cultural boundary without becoming something completely different. And so, you know, we've got a lot of ideas that are unsorted or like deeply pre-modern ideas that don't really integrate into a post-postmodern society and understanding. So we have both all the information, or a lot of information, and a lot of it is bad information, or at least information that isn't useful to us in its format. And I also see that, you know, there's a time limit here. Like, the world is rapidly dying unless something happens. So unless we, you know, you guys are doing a great job of getting people on your program who have something positive and useful to say about that. And yet, you know, we need to see some action happening on that front. I think that there's a real sense from our Christian background, or I'll say our Judeo-Christian background, where we want to come up to this ultimate moment where, yes, it's all speeding up. Yes, we're all getting more and more enlightened. Yes, there's a salvation coming where awakening is going to come down from the sky and all of us are going to be rise up to heaven, fly up to heaven with Jesus, right? There's just kind of that's our cultural myth. And it comes together, you know, very well with the end of the world type stuff. And I'm not sure. I'm not sure. But what I can say, I mean, in the grand scheme of humanity on this planet, I don't know. But I can say that at least for, you know, Europeans in post-capitalism, you know, we've got new access to this kind of information, and a lot more people are trying to do it. And so a lot more people in that tiny part of humanity are awakening to at least a little bit. And so if we narrow it down like that, I can say, I think there's more awakening happening, for sure. For sure.
Yeah. It also seems that a lot of the information is that top of the pyramid. So it's super, super abstract. And then people take it and they're like, oh, that's curious. But then the applying it is the hard part, right? So just the fact that we have more information doesn't really mean much if people aren't applying it.
And it's the application that is the sort of like 500 years process of building it into your culture, right? It's like we have to learn how to apply it by people in our culture who talk to us in our metaphor. Mm-hmm. And it turns out that's really, really powerful and meaningful. And so you're starting to get people who are, you know, writing useful stuff about how to do that. And yet they still learned it all in another cultural context, another cultural myth. So I think it's going to take another couple iterations before this starts to really land in our culture. And furthermore, I mean, our culture is a moving target, right? Whatever our culture is, you know, wherever it is, but let's just say white European culture, that's a moving target. And it's really changing really fast. And part of it is really advancing and part of it is just crumbling into dust. This is going to be a very interesting interchange, very interesting interaction between some of these very, very, very pre-modern schools of awakening that have a lot to say and our own post-postmodern, you know, life in, you know, the flaming on fire ruins of the post-capitalist planet, right? It's a fascinating moment and in a way a terrifying moment, but a moment with a lot of potential also.
Michael, thank you. This has been a very fun and informative conversation. So thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Mike. Thanks, Yubi. It's great to talk to you guys.
That's all for this episode with Michael Taft. For more of his work, check out his blog and podcast at deconstructingyourself.com. For all the links and show notes for this episode, go to futurethinkers.org/95.
And if you want to stay up to date with our latest episodes, blog posts, or news from Future Thinkers, join our mailing list at futurethinkers.org/mailing-list. To meet like-minded people, join our Future Thinkers Discord community. Go to futurethinkers.org/discord.
Check out A Course in Personal Evolution, adapting age-old wisdom for a modern life of purpose and meaning. Go to futurethinkers.org/evolution.
Don't forget to subscribe and hit the bell icon to get notified of new videos. You can also follow us on social media to stay connected. If you'd like to get a t-shirt like the new Make America Think Again, go to futurethinkers.org/store. If you like what we do and you want to help us make more podcasts and videos, consider donating or becoming a patron at futurethinkers.org/support. Also visit our sponsor Qualia and use the coupon code FUTURE to get 10% off your purchase.